that, Paul. I don't come here as often as I'd like to, so I'm very grateful that you asked me to finish off the year. You do terrific work and bring us all together, and you're so good as well to us at UCC, so our students are going to be reading here on the 4th, and thank you for reminding me, on the 4th of February, and thank you for giving us all a space to read our work and get to know each other. I'm going to start just with a little poem about home, where I'm going tomorrow. I'm from the Bear Peninsula in West Cork, and this is called Townland. For those of you who don't know what a townland is, in Beara anyway, they're just small designations of land. You could have three houses in it, one house, or a whole village. And what's special about the townlands in Beara anyway, I'm not sure if this is the case in the rest of the country, but the townlands very often are divided by streams that run overground and underground, and sometimes, like this summer, dried up completely. And I love that idea of boundaries that can be so fluid and movable that they disappear. And my father appears in this poem. He was in a neighbour who had died. She was an older, there's one person from home here, so I'm not going to mention any names, but she was an old woman. She was kind of a hag-like, wonderful woman. She had wiry grey hair, and she used to chew chewing gum in one side of her mouth and tobacco in the other side of her mouth. And she used to walk with a crutch, so you'd hear her coming up the aisle in Mass or in Super Value or wherever. And she died around Halloween, and my father decided he was going to get fit one cold dark night in November, and went out for a walk, and didn't get far before he heard this noise coming up behind him. So this is called Townland. A hankering in the skull uttered and worked, the stagger of heather beds cleaved in the throat, Garth and Atterbrook, and in the old stone walls, the swallows going like wind-borne rumours. An ordinary night, my father walking there, thought he'd heard the ghost of Nora Sear. The border streams swelling to the sound of her steel crutch tapping out the hours. Old homes and a half-remembered word of mouth, we'd prowl the lanes ourselves, calling her out. The underground all moan and winnow with disappearing streams and passages that swept the yellowing firs. Unlistened for, the roofless village a thousand times past, and beyond the waning lift and turn of a gate, the fall of banked moss, and all of us listening. It actually wasn't the ghost of Nora Sear, it was a neighbour with his shotgun, which didn't scare my father as much as the ghost of Nora Sear. So I'll just read one more from home. I grew up in a house with, it's a love poem, and about my grandparents, and I grew up in the same house as my grandmother. My grandfather had died before I was born, and my grandmother was kind of an old, kind of hag-like in the best sense woman as well, and very, very quiet and very stoic, and prayed a lot, and loved her farm, and very, very quiet woman. My grandfather apparently was the complete opposite, very mischievous. He had a job which was, and a car which was unusual in the 50s, 60s, 70s in Beara. He was a social worker, and he used to drive around the peninsula doing his business in the pubs while my grandmother was at home looking after her nine children and farming. And he was always kind of making fun of her and taking the piss really, and very good at mimicking people. One evening, he replaced her, swapped her hairspray for Vim. Do you remember Vim? Cleaning. And she just kind of, she didn't grin and bear it, but she put up with it. But one evening they were driving home from Cork, they were coming around the bend there at Ballylickey, where there are usually swans, and he said to her, Rita, you know, you'd make a beautiful swan. She didn't like it at all, and there was just banging and breaking of things for the next few days. But these were, she was devoted to him and absolutely adored him. And these were the love stories that I heard when I was growing up. Love stories. And when they fought, my father said, in those daylit, lamplit rooms, him bowed into the ceremonies of the newspapers, the sound would be of her slamming closed the cupboard doors, the front door, cups and plates smashed into the deep sink like a sudden downpour of hailstone. He would turn the pages very slowly so as not to disturb her, and mindful of knives where buttery spuds still plumed on the blade. And once, peering over the rim of the page, he calmly offered, "Would you prefer a hammer?" So that the whole thing started off again. For 3 days and nights, hinges turned over the world. Soft mortar crumbled somewhere down behind the dresser. And from the eaves, the nesting starlings darted and sprung in fright and raised the weathered roof like a sparking flare. So I'm going to read some of my own love poems, recent love poems. But I'm going to start with one, if I can find it, called Eumnestes. And poetry has come to mean something a little bit different for me over the past few years, and especially this year. I suppose we've all been listening to the news and David Attenborough's comments over the week and the headlines in the papers again today. And poetry for me has become so much a call to pay attention. And we were talking just a while ago about trying to slow time down, and Julie was saying, well, when you're, you know, poetry surely is a way to slow time down, and I really think it is. When we sit down to read or write a poem, it is a call to pay very, very close attention to what is happening around us, and that's what it means for me more and more. This poem is called Eumnestes, and my husband Andrew, some of you might know him, he's a lecturer in UCC, he's a Spencer scholar, and Spencer wrote a big massive poem called The Faerie Queen, some of you might have read it, yeah. And in book two of The Faerie Queen, the knight is making his way to a castle, which is an allegory for the body. So they enter in like through the stomach and the bowels, and they make their way up to the heart space, but they're trying to get up to the tower room, which is an allegory for the head and the brain and the mind and memory. And there's an old man in the tower whose job is to write down the history of the whole world. And I imagine him as being kind of like a Ribaldo Dwyer from Home, a genealogist. My national school teacher in Beira was a local genealogist historian, you know, back in the 80s and 90s. And maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, I went to visit him, and he brought me into his study where he did all of this genealogical work. And it was floor to ceiling of Ashling copybooks. You know, now we're everything on a computer and not a floppy disk, but on whatever things. But it was floor to ceiling of Ashling copybooks, and I imagine that's what Eumnestes Tower looks like. So Eumnestes, you know, he can see the past, and through that he can kind of predict the future, that we're always kind of making the same mistakes. Eumnestes, and it's in his voice. When I arrived in this country for the first time, I had in my possession only one book, and being almost completely alone, wrote in such detail everything I could remember. The Big Bang, the years of Nestor, the great disasters and disturbances of weather, world ending and world beginning, blue onto great darkness, onto blue again, onto temples and courtyards, onto kingdoms and faltering customs. Not that I fully understood, but in this way I have been useful, have minded how they lived, how they harvested cotton or grain, What seed caught in the amber drop? How once a man might have luckily sensed the danger meant for him, something creeping in the great dark expanse, just before he decided to turn around and come back, find another way. How he listened, watched for signs, for trails, or deciphered how a peal of light falling through the trees could mark roughly a way in, the way out again. So that he knew the path in the future must be, which is the reading I try to bear in mind. So I became preoccupied really with memory. It was always something I was, I think in poetry, you're always looking back and finding material from past experiences and ideas or whatever. But about 5 years ago, my brilliant husband got very, very sick. And some of you probably already know this, but it was this time of the year 5 years ago, and he got an infection that traveled into his brain. And he was in a coma for 3 weeks, and the infection caused his temperature to rise to 42 degrees Celsius, so he had blisters on his ears and on his arms, and it didn't look very good, but he did very well. I keep forgetting to say that part after what happened, but he did brilliantly. For the first couple of years, it was clear that the virus had actually burned out his memory when he woke up. He was very much destroyed by it, and conveniently didn't remember that he had gotten married. And I was calling him husband, just to try and get him to, and he would just call me wife, I think, because he felt it was the most logical answer. I think he milked that one for longer than he needed it. But the other thing that was really striking about his recovery was hallucinations that he was having, or what I suppose I would have called at the time hallucinations, but I've come to think of it in a different way. We were sitting in the hospital one day, and he was having his dinner, you know, at the side of the bed, and they bring the wheel, the dinner to you. And he said to me, and he was utterly confused, but he said, this is amazing, you know, you wouldn't think we're 3,000 feet up in the air now, would you? And I said, well, actually, we're not actually, and I hadn't told him anything, you know, about why he was there or where he was. And I thought this was the time. And I told him he was in hospital, and he said, and what had happened to him. And he's an academic, so I thought it would devastate him learning that he had such an attack on his brain. But he said, no, that's very interesting. He said, yeah, it is very interesting. And he said, I think I'd rather be in the bonds, like private hospital. And I said, brilliant, he's making decisions, and he's, you know, he wants things, and he's taking charge. And I said, no problem, we'll get you to, I don't know how he was going to get to the bonds, because he could barely hold himself up. But I said, can I just ask why you'd rather be in the bonds? And he said, well, I think it might be a more controlled environment. I think they might have fewer wild animals wandering around the hall. And I, as his wife at the time, I said, if a doctor comes around here, don't say a word about wild animals. We've been there for months at this stage, and I just wanted him home. But over the course of the next year and a half, they persisted, foxes, wildcats, and some raccoons, he said, because he's from North America. It was interesting to see when they would come up, when he was anxious, when he was distressed, when he was afraid of something. He could hear them, he could even smell them. At a certain point I had to kind of enter into it and kind of say they were guiding him back in some way. And I was thinking about the extreme weather we were having at the time as well, 2013, 2014, and thinking about the way that the planet is heating up and we're losing species of plants and animals that we're never going to be able to remember and put back together. And these animals did seem to be a kind of a primal or indicative of some kind of primal healing that was going on. But just before he got sick, maybe a couple of weeks before, we had gone out for a walk, and we found a fox, a little fox that was dead on the road. No mark on her, but had obviously been hit by a car. And Andrew picked her up to put her into the side of the road on the grass so she wouldn't be destroyed by cars. And I wondered if something of that creature had kind of entered into him, because when we came back later in the day, the fox had disappeared. So the fox. We were just returning home when the light began to fade. That gold, quiet brilliance you waited for at the gate. When we crossed the lane for the last time and suddenly came to the open-mouthed body of the fox lying on the road ahead of us, her tail flared out behind her, her fur all live and glandular in the evening air. The day was still warm along her shoulders, and in the one exploded eye that held a shape you could not recognize, the name of the river folding back along the river, the bright trails, the way to the long grasses, and whatever had passed through there in the night. And before it all vanished into darkness, you had lifted her into your arms and gestured to me and gently set her down like a small fire among the grasses. So soft, you said she could almost pass through you in that light. And what happened next? Did the great pain come? You forget. When we came back the next morning, she was gone. No sign or scent, no brightness in the trails, no memory bearing down, but mine to tell now with all the clearness of the morning after. You see, by the time sunlight had passed through the last amber and orbit of her eye, we had just been setting out. She had already become part of this story. Mm. How the autumn dawn burned through the misty broods and settled down in fire. How quickly the sun glittered my shadow. How my shadow cried a moment with joy. A light frost. A vision of light crackling down the maples, down the tinder ash. I was the good thief. I held my love's sweet breath, his beautiful, intelligent gaze. I closed my eyes and he woke inside me. When I saw, he saw the inflamed world. A bird sang deeply from the gutter eaves. When I closed my eyes, I was elsewhere. I walked through the fire of his sleep. Mm. I was trying to find like a Christmassy poem. there is one that's not very happy though. I was doing a reading during the summer, there was a musician kind of accompanying us, and she said, what kind of air? And it's sort of, it isn't jaunty anyway with my lot of poems, but he was in CUH like for months, and over Christmas time, and I used to take him down, wheel him down to the chapel in CUH because it was quiet. And we went in, and the crib had been set up. That was the first day, and the, I suppose it's, who's in the crib? The three wise men, an angel.
Jesus.
And the second day we came down, there was a bunny in the manger, bigger than all of the other figures. And this was on one side of the altar, and way over on the other side. And there was a little road. They had made a little road as well, like, and there was Joseph and Mary on the way. but you couldn't see them; they were behind the altar. And people would come in and, you know, kneel down in the chapel and pray. And I thought, this is the main guy, like the head honcho. So, a nativity. Of course, things had gone from bad to worse, with the storm outside near washing the world away, and everyone flocked to the chapel for shelter. How strange then, drawing closer to the scene, the empty crib, the petrified magi, to find him there, the one clay rabbit at the center of it all, as though a god of the springtime had mysteriously risen or rolled a stone back from our minds. His outstretched paws, his round dark eyes, in one sense made him human, whose gaze was gentleness, a thief who was friend to many, or a beggar whose beauty shone in his seeing you. He remembered the dark of the true forest, understood the light, the fall of light among the trees, the sound and sleep of absolute sanctuary. And no, we did not think to question. Desperation, he knew, became our defense, the one cherished seed that was our hope. Mothers and fathers who had not knelt in years bowed before him and murmured in harmony, so that a kind of music trickled along the pews and was carried on into the night. For always, they say, there is a light in the storm, a voice heard in the great essential winds. And always, it seems, an hour of peace, even with the world outside trying frantically to come to an end, and the Holy Family still a good way off. So he remembered absolutely nothing, and vocabulary as well was a big problem for him, and you know, naming things, and it was an incredible experience for a couple of years to be with somebody who was remembering himself into the world again. And for Andrew, it was the garden, going out into the garden, I suppose, doing a job, coming back the next day and seeing that it was done, realizing that, you know, tree was the word for tree and not anything else. So this is called Morning Poem. Of course, memory began in the garden, going out to it so early, that first morning home. The little bells of the dawn, not yet too loud or too deep. The world around him, still only half asleep. Oh, Byzantium, he thought, fingering the spires of the foxgloves, and the berries ghosting along the bramble, and the beams grown rotten into the ground. The things we have seen, the sweet accidental parts of our lives, stooping largely in their rough matins. Where are we now? Somewhere near him, a stone unsettles itself, and a beast in the blue light turns over. What sound do you make to find that? What symbol means nothing at all? I'm gonna switch back to home for a minute. My lovely grandmother again, my grandmother used to be in charge of getting the house ready for the station mass. I don't know if any of you know what a station mass is. Can I have a show of hands?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. So that's brilliant. And does anyone still have station masses set in their house home?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, we do. So station mass is another jolly story from the penal times in Ireland, when Catholics weren't allowed to attend mass in the churches. So they used to go into the mountains, into the woods, and secretly into the homes of the congregation as well, and have mass in secret. And it was a tradition that carried on and on and on. So in my grandmother's day, it was a bit of whitewashing, a bit of cooking, and you invite like all the neighbours, the priest and the Holy Ghost into your house. So it's a big deal, and it's the woman's work is so important as well, getting the house ready for the state of mass, cooking and cleaning. And my grandmother used to do a lovely job, and and then my mother took over, like, the start of the noughties, and the Celtic Tiger station masses meant knocking down walls and building conservatories. And they were lovely. Well, in our, I just saw, like, all the conservatories that went up, like, and in Barry it was just, like,
It was God's will.
So I wanted to write a little picture, my grandmother getting the house ready for the station mass. Everything scrubbed down and scrubbed again. Every room followed its own lighted passage, singing out its corners and the polished dark. The makeshift altar set, she moved from room to room, pelting the floors with her slippered walk. And down in the kitchen, the beautiful spread of meals, the little locks and curls of butter flaring sunlight. We were like her sentry guards in doorways, barefoot, sweeping for mopes and blemishes, our eyeing hiding places that suddenly stood clear. Roses, silver, lace, the glasses breathed against. Then the gravel call of priest and neighbours up the lane, and we were all come and go again, herself gone ahead of us down the last swept path, snapping incantations, scattering light. This is called Safe House, and I wrote it, I suppose, around 2009, 2010, when we were starting to hear those terrible stories about what had been happening to children in industrial schools. And around that time, a friend of mine told me this story about her family during the time of the Irish War for Independence, when the old IRA would go to hide in ordinary family homes from the old British soldiers. And what struck me when she told me this story was what happened to the little boy in the house. They had one child at the time. And it, when she told me this story, it became kind of the kind of archetypal story for me, which proved what had what was to happen to children on this island. Safe House. When they were beginning to build a country, some of the men came to hide in a house where there was a family and a child upstairs listening. They told him what to say if anyone ever asked. Say they were never there. Say there was only a family in that house. And during the night, the boy went to the room where their bags and belongings were hidden. He felt along the canvases, the mouldy wet and sag of the straps. His fingers touched on papers and coins and lifted out the revolver, its coolness and the weight of it in his hands. Then he felt nothing. His blood crept slowly and dark along the floorboards underneath them, and the room shook and stood still and seemed to hang for a moment in that night. When they found him, they cleaned him, his face, gently and quickly, and his mother wrapped him in a blanket and took him out to a corner of the farm and buried him. Back in the house, they gathered his things and built up a fire again in the kitchen, burning his clothes, his shoes, all the signs and small clumsy turnings of a child. And afterwards, in the freezing dark, the father went out to find the doctor and the parish priest to tell them what had happened and what they should say if anyone ever asked. Tell them there was never a child. Say they were never there. There was never a home or the found easy measures of a family. There was never a map that could lead back to or out of that place, foreknown or imagined, where the furs, the dark-rooted vetch turned over and over with the old ground and disappeared.
Yeah.
So we'll finish up with maybe two or three. One is kind of, this is a little tiny bit longer that I'm used to. So do you remember Eumnestes at the very start, which means good memory, this old man up in the tower, documenting the history of the world? Well, because he was such an old, feeble man, he had a little boy named Anamnestes, who used to rush and get the books when people would call to the tower, call to the castle. Anamnestes, it was his job to get the books off the shelves because Eumnestes couldn't get there fast enough to retrieve the information. And Anamnestes means little memory minder, a little memory helper. And Anamnestes had never left the tower. He was just forever a little boy. And I imagined him, one day reading about the world and wanting to go out and experience it himself and live those memories. So this is a letter that he writes years later to Eumnestes. Old man, I am thinking about you today. The years have taken off, and if you're living only in my mind and nowhere else, I can't be certain. But in light of everything that has come and gone, I thought it right to make this brief connection. You see, there was always more to it than just a boy in the outback of a library, living and growing among the oakwood stacks, fetching books and histories when people would knock on your door inquiring who they truly were and where they were really from. Then one late night while you were sleeping, out of curiosity, I crept back in. The lamps were dim and dampness sweated down the rough stone walls, but still I gathered and balanced in my arms all that I could and sat cross-legged upon the floor, vague as a ghost boy, washed clean of memory, and began to read of the history of the courts, of tribunals and their theatres, of commonwealth, of policies and of law, the sciences and all philosophies. Then cities of stone and steel were raised up before me, the grand romancers, the men of the court, the king's men, and the man of solitude, the man of wisdom, and the blind man holding forth, the man of letters, and the man of the world. Some had their names in books, and some in long parchment scrolls, worm-eaten and canker-holed. Then in the book of the ancestors, I read them first, the creatures of the forest, and names I had not heard before or since, their syllables a blood knot, a tonnage in the sound of the sea, in the eye of God, in the scriptural ashen geographies, in the moment of conception, the moment of birth, of love, of light treading the air, of what's immeasurable, the matter of just memory in the rhymes and furies of all the world. A world I saw I could live in, and in it become anyone. When morning glanced along the shutters, I rose light-headed for the first time, and for the first time in my life I was gone, travelling down the narrow road with the grass banks so heavy white with snow, it felt as though my own shoulders were broadening out to touch them. And so the years have passed, and it was no easy thing. You yourself knew that. Metaphors of light and always an image of the road on which we set out. But now I hope it has not been too long. Eumnestes, out of the words you wrote, mine were borrowed but followed their own meandering course. If you are there to read them, be sure and know that life is still turning, and it's a mystery what can be born. I say this truthfully, because in the end, I had done it alone. stood at the step of my own front door as at the portals of your house and breathed the full of it. I put my ear to the machinery of the deep earth and listened. I came to understand it myself. I'm gonna finish with another little memory poem. And thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Paul again. When words, he thought tree was wife, returning to the field with her no longer there. And for weeks now, field was not the same as home when he tried to call out. So deaf and dumb that nothing seemed to answer him or come back. It wasn't the tree he missed, but the sound for tree, and the fox illuminated as it slipped past. It was that kind of silence, the way the earth is vague before dawn, the first sounds not yet breaking through. When does pond become sky, he thought, leaning over it, brain where everything crawls into detail, bare and particular and known completely. Such a private thing, really, the world easing out of nothingness. Remember, try it out loud this time, the pond turning bluish first, then grey. Remember like that. It's never as lost as you think.
Well, I could listen to those all night.
Yes.
We don't have all night, unfortunately. We've got a very full open mic. We're going to have to start a really, really short, very quick break. But please, one last round of applause. Yeah.